Although the gut engines in the trucks seem to have been protected from Quagma Phantom attack by improvised shelters of hull plate, Poole had never been happy with similar attempts to rig a gut engine inside the tight hull of the flyer. There wasn't the room for shielding. Hence, fusion power only, with various kinds of battery backup. Poole ran the fusion engine through one final start-up shutdown cycle. Then at last, he nodded. Let's get aboard. Chapter 50. With Nicola, inevitably at the controls, the flyer lifted smoothly off the tilted rock surface of the rim. At first, with the air density negligible, the flyer was powered, as if for vacuum flight, by high-performance fusion heat rockets with internal propellant tanks. Nicola tested out the controls, careful not to let the flyer ride up and touch the force field sky. Then, with an extravagant gesture, she sent the craft on a long, sweeping dive, down, down past the rocky face of the peripheral cliffs, down and seeking the thicker air, where the ramjets would cut in. Atmospheric air sucked in and superheated to be used as propellant. Deeper yet, when the atmosphere was thick enough, the flyer would become a true aircraft, relying for lift on the thickness of the air flowing over its wings. Poole, sitting up front with Nicola, glared out. Asher was intent on her screens and other monitors. Cinello pointed back over her shoulder. The Rim Mountains, she pointed up. The lid. We ought to start naming stuff, if we're going to live here. Nicola said, There may be people here already, of course, who already gave stuff names of their own. Kind of disrespectful not to ask, don't you think? Cinello scoffed. Look down there. What people? Where? I can't answer that, Asher said. Not yet. But I can tell you that this world not only looks like Earth, it is turning out to be like Earth in the detail. Oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere. Thick enough down there to be breathable for us, and without any nasties, not an excessive carbon dioxide percentage, for instance. A lack of ozone, but maybe that's insignificant given the shielding effect of the lid. Earth-like, if not Earth. But the humidity is down compared to the Earth average. You mean it's dry? Cinello said. Like a desert? Not quite. I can tell that much. And I never saw a planet before. At 40 kilometres now, Nicola said. Aero surface is starting to bite. A glance out of the window showed Jophiel how she was still tracking down the face of the Rim Mountains, leading the craft through smooth, S-shaped curves as the flyer's aero surfaces explored the unfamiliar air. Asher said thoughtfully, Well, you're right, Cinello. My first estimates say there is about 1/3 ocean cover here, to 2/3 land. The reverse of the proportions on Earth. And the air is a little thin and lacking water vapour. There must be a ferocious dip in temperatures at night, even if it's hot during the day, like a high desert on Earth. Nicola grunted. You're missing the fundamentals. What night? This isn't a planet. It doesn't spin on its axis. It doesn't orbit a sun. It can't have a day-night cycle. I know there are worlds that keep one face to their stars the whole time, but life like ours evolved on worlds that spin. True enough, Asher murmured. So if you were going to build a refuge, maybe you'd mimic some kind of day-night cycle. Life from Earth at least depends on it. Jophiel nodded, and he leaned forward so he could see the sky, the lid. Hence maybe those stripes of shadow. From underneath, that flow-like effect in the sky was much more marked, a clear diminution of the light in huge, swirling, interlocking bands. And where the bands were at their most opaque, Jophiel saw, significant shadows were cast on the ground below. "Like zebra stripes," Chinello said. "Not that I ever saw a zebra." Asher stared. "You're right, though. That is how it looks, a sort of organic self-organizing pattern. And this must be it, the key to day and night. Over a given spot on the ground, those bands coalesce or scatter, blocking or admitting the light through the lid. It's going to take some analyzing, starting with the timing of the cycle. I wonder if it's smart enough to mimic seasonality, or the effect of latitude, long polar nights." Nicola grinned, not unkindly, as far as Jophiel could read the expression on her silvered face. "You've got a lot of fun studying to do, that's for sure." Abruptly, reflected light flared through the pilot's window. Even Jophiel winced before the windows cut down the incident light. Looking out, he saw they were descending past a brilliant white surface. "Sorry," Nicola said. "Got too interested in your fascinating conversation." "Flying down smooth and easy. We just ducked under 8 kilometers from the mean surface. We're no higher than the tallest mountains on Earth now, and we're flying parallel to that reflective layer in the rock face." Jophiel looked out at what looked like a snowfield clinging to the upper flanks of the rim mountains. "So I guess we're at an altitude where ice is going to form." "Maybe," Asher said, staring at her soft screen rather than the view. "But that's not ice, or not all of it. That's hull plate, I think, or some variant. Not much of it, just a skim." Poole frowned. "It doesn't look like hull plate. Not the usual texture. And look at its lower edge. It looks like it's turning brown, crumbling even." "Aha," Asher said. That irritated Nicola. "You can be smug, Fennell. Some new puzzle you figured out?" "I think I know how the mountains stay up instead of eroding away. I'll tell you when I'm sure." Flying low now and evidently handling easily, the flyer fled directly away from the rim mountains into the interior of the cup world. Chapter 51. They flew over rusty plains, briny-looking lakes. It resembled Mars, Jophiel thought. Or at any rate, a partially terraformed Mars, one dream that had never been fulfilled before the Chile came. Yet there was life here. Jophiel made out clumps of tough-looking grasses now, and even stubby trees, their leaves small, the species unrecognizable, to Jophiel anyhow. But then the pools had never been naturalists. "High Australia," Chinello said now. They looked at her. "The name for this place, I was thinking. I saw virtuals of Australia on the Couchy." Probably, Jophiel knew, last chance to see records of Earth before it was lost to the displacement and the cold. "You wouldn't let me be first out through the lid. At least you can let me name it." "I keep reminding you," Nicola said. "There might be people here already, human or not, and they might already have their own name. What is that?" Jophiel glimpsed motion on the ground below. It was gone in a glimpse, such was the flyer's speed. But Jophiel thought he had seen a gaggle of what looked like big, long-legged chickens, being chased by what looked like a big, long-legged rat. "Earth-like," was Nicola's only comment. "Slightly evolved, maybe, but clearly Earth stock." "From the scatter ships," Jophiel said, "captured like the ghosts took Chen's ship, brought here, released into the wild." "Not much time for evolution," Asher murmured. "Like we said, this cup world can't be more than a few thousand years old locally. I suppose some quick adaptation is possible. Plenty of ecological niches to fill in such an empty landscape." Poole just shrugged. "We don't know enough yet." "So," Nicola said, Should I divert and chase those chickens? Asher asked, Are we still heading for the ocean? Right now, yes. Then keep on in that direction. Poole frowned. Why the ocean? I'll tell you when I know more. So they flew on, over more flat terrain, across which wandered rivers wide and shallow, their water sluggish, red-tinged. Jophiel wondered if the stream he had seen coming out of the Rim Mountains had become a tributary of one of these weary flows. He glimpsed more life, trees and scrub grass and other less identifiable vegetation, mainly growing close to the watercourses. And here and there, where the water was more accessible, at shallow banks and around oases that reflected the sky with pink glimmers, he saw animals, cautiously gathering to drink, he supposed. More variants, he thought at first glance, on the theme of rat and bird. If this was a biosphere, it was an impoverished one, although from what he recalled of the original Australia, watching from the air you would have seen little of life but kangaroos and wallabies and humans, with much of the detail of a still rich fauna to be discovered down at ground level. The daylight seemed to be getting brighter, Jophiel thought. Evidently they had arrived by chance in a simulated morning. As they approached the ocean, the landscape subtly changed, with the sandy soil mounting up into fields of long, shallow dunes, and the grass becoming scrubbier, paler, longer. Then they flew out over the ocean itself. Asher was intent on her screens. Nicola murmured, Do you think there are tides here? I wonder how you would simulate that. How far out do you want me to go? This pond could be pretty wide. And, said Poole, ever cautious, by flying over water we lose several fail-safe modes. Just keep on, Asher snapped, still intent. Jophiel stared down at the grey ocean, low waves rushing beneath the craft's prow. He wondered what life might be found down there. Some of the scatterships, carrying scraps of Earth's doomed ecosphere to the stars, had been more or less aquatic, he recalled. Some had even carried fish, dolphins, dwarf whales, and the plankton and the rest of the food chain they depended on. He pictured all of them spilling out of some cargo hold, spreading out into another huge empty biome. And maybe land grasses mutating to some kind of seaweed, perhaps, or rats evolving into the equivalents of otters or seals. I knew it! Asher shouted now. Nicola grunted. Thanks for yelling in the pilot's ear. What did you know? The answer. To what? That puzzle about the erosion. How can a world without any geology not get worn flat, all of the mountains eroded away into sea-bottom ooze? I think I have it. Nicola said, Terrific. Now do you mind if we turn around and head back before we run out of fusion fuel? As the flyer banked, Asher spoke eagerly. You were right, of course, Nicola. Erosion must occur even here. Now, there's no geological process of uplift to compensate for that erosion. This is just a big machine. And so I knew there must be some mechanical solution. Huge pumps, Poole guessed. Taking the sea-bottom ooze, consolidating it and pumping it up to be dumped on top of the mountains again. No. Asher said bluntly. I thought of that. Firstly, we saw no sign of pumps and pipes. Second, it's not the Chile way. It's not elegant. I think they would do it using the hull plate approach. Jophiel thought that over. Converting energy to mass. Suppose they repaired the erosion on the mountain tops with mass nucleated out of energy flows from the sky. The result might be that odd-looking hull plate we saw at 5 kilometres. Asher nodded eagerly. That's what I'm thinking. Just where the erosion would start kicking in. Where the air is thick enough, yes. I looked it up. On Earth before the displacement, weathering around the world would deliver dust to the abyssal plains. The ocean deeps at a slow but steady rate. 2 or 3 centimeters thickness per 1,000 years. But that is a lot of stuff, a few centimeters over deeps that covered half the planet's surface. Okay. So you're suggesting that Chile fixed the loss from the mountains with an energy mass transformation, even at such a rate that must be an expensive power drain? I figure it's pretty high, yes. Something like 100,000 times the energy Earth once received from the sun. But this isn't the Earth. But you'd need to deal with the deposition in the ocean basins, as well as the erosion from the peaks. I was looking for mass loss down there to match the deposition rate, and I found it. She tapped her soft screen. A tiny effect, but we have sensitive instruments. Probably the mass loss and creation are connected to the wider hull plate river network, a tremendous flow of massed energy. Compared to that, all of this is detail. Poole scowled. Good work, he said, sounding indifferent. Asher scowled and shut up. They turned and flew back over the coast at a lower altitude, and Jophiel started to make out a new set of features now. At first they looked like shallow craters, like the moons, each a neat circle of rim wall a couple of kilometres across, with a stubby hill or mound in the centre. Yet the features seemed somehow too orderly, too similar in size to be the product of impacts, and besides, he'd have expected the Chile defence to keep out minor impactors. These features were sparsely scattered, but there were a lot of them, he saw now, panning over the landscape. Some vaguely clustered close to visible water sources, others were more haphazard. They flew on for a while. Then Nicola banked the flyer sharply, heading to the right. "Hey, Chinello! You want to know what this place is called?" She pointed out of her window. Jophiel leaned over to look. There was a woman on the ground. "Ask her," Nicola said. Nicola brought the flyer down, slow, smooth and quiet, a good distance from the woman. The native, Jophiel thought they would have to call her. "Don't want to rustle a hair on her head," Nicola murmured. She stood alone near a rock bluff, her skin dark, her hair wild, her clothing looking like rags, her feet bare. She had some kind of pack on her back. On Poole's command, they climbed out one at a time, slowly, hands away from the body, empty and open, as unthreatening as possible. Nicola, the scary silver statue, was ordered to follow behind the rest. If Nicola was last out, Chinello had been first. "Leith," she murmured. "Another first footstep for me and nobody even noticed." "Can it?" Poole said. "No sudden moves, nobody call out. We've got no idea what we've walked into here. She needs to know we've come in peace. Let's go forward together." The light was quite bright, Jophiel noticed as he walked into this new world. Indeed, a new kind of world. Like a hazy sunlight, flat and shadowless from a glowing sky. The woman stood alone, a scrap of verticality in a flat landscape beside her rock bluff. Quite unmoving. Hands loose at her sides, as empty as the visitors. Jophiel made out a few more details. A black scar on the ground behind her might be the remains of a fire. She seemed to have backed this rudimentary campsite up against the bluff, as if for cover, which in turn implied, of course, there was something she needed cover from. When they had got to within 20 or 30 paces, they stopped, and Jophiel held his hands up.
Let me go first.
Nicholas snorted. You aren't even real.
I look real enough, Jophiel said. And I can't come to any harm. I can't do any harm.
Just go, Poole said tensely.
Jophiel spread his hands wider, fixed a grin, and walked forward alone towards the woman.
And he didn't even see the woman's motions. Not until later, when he relived the experience as a slow-motion flashback. She had reached behind her back with two hands. One had emerged with a small but sturdy bow, the other with an arrow. She knocked the arrow, fired, turned, and ran. Later, Jophiel would muse on how many hours, years of practice those simple, artful motions represented. The arrow was well made too, a finely sharpened stick, apparently fire-hardened, a flight of what looked like chicken feathers. In real time, he had little chance to observe any of this as the arrow passed through the space between his eyes. There was a wrenching, unreal sensation as his consistency protocols were violated as never before. He staggered, but didn't fall. Cinello grunted, "Leave her to me." And she ran after the fleeing woman. That was when Jophiel heard Nicola cry out. He whirled around. The arrow had dipped a little in its path as it had flown on to its second target. It was buried in Nicola's chest, buried up to its flight, and she was already falling. Ignoring his own consistency violation agony, Jophiel started to run back. Poole and Asher moved too, trying to grab Nicola before she hit the ground.
"Got her!" Cinello called over their comms link. "The local, with my blaster, shot her in the back. Just stunned her. Bet you're glad now that Max Ward put us through weapons drill, Michael." "Oh, one thing I noticed. She's from the Gord."
Chapter 52. Up close, the woman was surprisingly small in stature. Jophiel might have mistaken her for a 10-year-old among the crew, but she was clearly much older than that, lithe, strong-looking, and her hair was a scraped, short frizz of grey curls. They had to get both Nicola and the Cupworld woman back to the flyer. Cinello was able to carry the unconscious woman over one shoulder, her blaster in the other hand. Asher and Poole, meanwhile, cradled Nicola one to either side, their arms interlocked around her waist. That arrow protruded horribly from the centre of her silvered chest, but there was no blood, no blood equivalent, and Jophiel realised uneasily how little he knew in detail of Nicola's adapted anatomy. He hoped Harris Kemp and his team would know more. Such was Nicola's weight that both Poole and Asher were struggling, sweating, stumbling as they made for the flyer. Jophiel, feeling useless, hurried alongside.
"I'm sorry, I can't help you."
Poole grunted.
"I wonder if Columbus had this kind of trouble."
"The Hawaiians killed Captain Cook,"
Nicola mumbled now. She raised a blank face. Her voice, too, was eerily expressionless. Jophiel was surprised she was conscious at all, and wondered if some kind of backup system was cutting in.
"Just for once, will you shut up, Poole? Every time you flap your mouth, this leaf-spawned arrow feels like it twists around."
"You keep quiet, too, then," Poole said with grim determination. "Nearly there."
Back at the fly, they found that Harris Kemp had already thrown down a skin-suited virtual copy from the convoy at the top of the Rim Mountains. He supervised briskly as Asher and Poole manhandled their limp, heavy, awkward, precious load through a hatch that suddenly seemed much too small for the purpose. Cinello, meanwhile, carried her prisoner around the back of the flyer, where there was a small cargo hold with no access to the cabin. She dumped the native inside, leaving the woman's pack on the ground outside, climbed in herself and pulled the hatch closed after her. Jofiel said uncertainly.
I guess that's the right thing to do.
What else could she do? Stake the woman to the ground, but...
But we just imprisoned the first local we saw. Some first contact. And Chinello is only 16 years old, Asher said.
She and Poole were, under Kemp's instructions, scrubbing down a couch with antiseptic gel in preparation for laying Nicola on top of it. Nicola herself for now was slumped over in her favoured pilot's couch. Not that she was going to be doing any piloting any time soon. And in a chilling bit of ship's procedure, Asher had already slapped a bracelet on her wrist, stamped with the name of the couchie and Nicola's name, ship's date, time of injury. Still that arrow protruded from her chest. It was only wood and feathers and some kind of glue Jofiel saw, yet it was a thing of artistry in itself. Harris said to Jofiel, "We have to stabilize her. But the good news is that I'm confident Nicola's going to survive. That's because her inner layout is a jumble compared to ours. In fact, Nicola's heart is down in her stomach cavity, and the arrow hit one of the complementary components the ghosts loaded in there. It's like a sack of seaweed. But look, this will be a complex procedure. That's precisely because her inner layout is a mess. You two." He pointed to Asher and Poole. "Scrub with gel. I can instruct, but you're going to have to do the heavy lifting. In the meantime, Jofiel..."
"You're in the way," Poole growled.
Jofiel glanced over at Nicola once more.
"Tell me when you have news."
And with a sub-vocal command, he threw himself into the hold. Where, among smooth-walled boxes of supplies and spare parts, the captive woman was awake and wide-eyed and facing an armed Chinello. When Jofiel materialized out of nowhere, the local did an admirable job, Jofiel thought, of staying calm. In fact, when she had got over a reflex startle, she jabbered a string of words at him. Her tone was challenging, her words incomprehensible, though Jofiel thought some of the vocabulary was elusively on the edge of familiar. Chinello, a little glassy-eyed, kept her blaster pointing at the woman. Maybe she was working through the shock, Jofiel thought.
"Keep her talking," Jofiel said.
"She won't stop talking." "Good. So we already have a few minutes' worth of records to work with." With a subvocal command, he set a translation routine working in the ship's processing suite, ordering it to download any results straight to his own awareness. Meanwhile, he smiled at the woman, as calmly and reassuringly as he could, trying not to think of the arrow this woman had shot into his friend, an arrow meant for him, in fact. After all, he was the alien invader here.
"My name is Jofiel.
I imagine you're wondering why I'm an identical copy of the other man you saw. He's called Michael." The woman just stared back and gabbled some more.
"That's it. Good. Just keep talking. Give the translator processor a chance to work."
Chinello said, "She tried to bust out twice."
"What did you do?"
Chinello waggled her blaster. "Stun setting. Milder than when I took her down outside."
Jofiel stared. "How old are you again?
You don't fool around, do you?" For the first time, Chinello sounded uncertain. "Did I do wrong? This is how Max trained us. A weapon isn't some magic wand that controls people when you wave it around. You have to use it. I was on my own in here. If she had got away, broken out..."
"It's okay. As far as I can see, you did exactly the right thing. In fact, if not for your quick decision-making, the rest of us couldn't have concentrated on Nicola as we did. I'll report back to Max when he gets here. Good job, Chinello."
She stayed expressionless but seemed calmer.
"Okay. But what now?"
"Now we need to make contact with this woman. Just be patient." Still she spoke. Still they waited for the translator software to cut in. Though again he thought he detected repeated words, phrases. Some of them sounded like much-evolved versions of Standard, his own language. Her name, maybe. Demands to be let free. Threats of retribution. Not, he thought, pleas for her life. She looked too defiant for that. At least he had the opportunity to study the woman up close. She wore a smock of some kind of hide, scraped and stitched together quite finely, with threads of what looked like tree bark, leaving her arms and legs bare. Boots of a tougher leather, the bare skin of her arms, legs, even her face was covered, he saw now, by a fine pattern of tracery of lines, thin and black, nowhere interlocking. Tattoos like an image of the sky. "This is how people live, in an environment like this," he said to Cinello. "A bare landscape, resource depleted. They turn in on themselves in a way. Their own bodies become a canvas. We call this place High Australia because of the landscape. Maybe it has some cultural similarities too." "She's kind of short," Cinello said. "Shorter than me, shorter even than you." "Thanks," Jophiel said dryly. "But it's a common adaptation among animals anyhow. Any place where there isn't much to eat. A person half your height would need only an eighth the food you eat. The square cube law." "Do you think she's still human? I mean, these people have been here all on their own for a long time." He shook his head. "Not that long. On this deck, it's only a few thousand subjective years since the wheel was created, remember? These people can't have been here longer than that. That's enough time for cultural institutions to collapse, changes in language, and for this woman's people to adapt to a lousy food supply by growing a little shorter than her ancestors. But she's human, all right." He looked at Cinello. "Out there, you said she was from the Gord, the ship that was captured and taken to Guba Sea by the ghosts." The woman looked startled at that evidently familiar word, Gord. "How could you know that?" Cinello grinned. "My young eyes are sharper than yours, I guess, Jophiel." She pointed. "Look for yourself." On one wrist, Jophiel saw now, the woman wore a medical bracelet, just like the one Nicola was wearing right now in the cabin. Virtually indestructible, it could well last for millennia if cared for, Jophiel realized. And on its worn surface, one word was clearly visible. The name of the ship it had come from whose crew this woman's ancestors must derive. Gord. Suddenly her speech became clear, rendered into accent-free standard by the flyer's software.
"My name is Weena. I am of the people of the vanquished first slaver. You need not thank me for saving you from the first slaver woman."
"I... what people? Who? Never mind. Very well. I won't thank you. She was, is, a friend. The, first slaver woman. My name is Jophiel." She listened carefully.
"Jophiel."
"That's right. This is Cinello." Cinello grinned and raised the weapon. "And this is called a blaster." The woman looked at the blaster dismissively, then studied Jophiel, evidently suspicious. He nodded. "You may have observed I am different from the others. Different from you." Jophiel passed his hand into the wall and out again, with a tingle of consistency protocol violation. "You must not be alarmed by this." The woman thought it over.
"Can you use a bow?"
"No, I..."
"You will soon go hungry, then."
Cinello suppressed a snort of laughter. "And you may have wondered why I am identical to the other man you saw." She thought that over.
"He who carried the wounded first slaver woman."
"Why do you call her slaver? Never mind. Yes, that man.
She shrugged.
You are nothing like him. Will you let me go now? I must hunt, or my family will soon go hungry.
Then came a message from Max. Aerial surveys had revealed what looked like the woman's home base. Teepees, built in the corpse of a downed spline ship. Chapter 53. Ship elapsed time since launch. 26 years, 64 days. 7 days later, a party from the convoy took the local woman home. It had been easy enough to locate the woman's community out in this tabletop of a landscape. Max Ward had flown down from the rim and put himself in charge, however, and he decreed the Couchy crew should walk in from the site where the flyer had first grounded rather than fly. The less obtrusive an entrance they made, the better. A flying machine would presumably terrify or enrage a people dependent on bows and arrows, and, Max argued, the less they showed off their strength, the better. They did leave Nicola behind over her protests, as she was still recuperating, and in the interests of diplomacy, given the way she had alarmed Weena enough on first contact that the woman had immediately tried to kill her. So, led by Weena, the party set off. It turned out to be a tough 10-kilometer march over bare, unyielding grounds. En route, they were chased by chickens. At least Jophiel thought they were chickens, or some kind of descendants. Muscular-looking birds the size of turkeys, with colourful plumages of gold and green, stocky legs and crests of virulent red. All males, according to Harris Kemp, and according to his soft screens, they looked a little like the guinea fowl from which domesticated chickens had descended. The birds took great offence to the passage of these unfamiliar humans, and their determination to give chase wasn't deflected by the felling of a couple of them by Max Ward's blasters. Weena showed them that standing still, shouting and waving your arms worked a lot better. Still, they got through the journey in a reasonable time. Max Ward had planned it out. They had started early, not long after this cupworld's eerie dawn, and arrived mid-afternoon of the local 23-hour day. And even from the ground, the village of the people of the vanquished first slaver was not hard to find. For, as the aerial surveys had already discovered, it nestled in the shadow of the great carcass of a spline warship. A few hundred metres from the village, the Couchy party hung back, to recover, re-equip, and spy out the land before going in. From this distance the relic of the spline looked like the stripped skeleton of a whale, Jophiel thought. Giant ribs towered over the scrappy human settlement, like the ruin of some tremendous cathedral. It was a relic of some incomprehensible, forgotten war, Jophiel supposed. Yes, and this was how interstellar war would leave a galaxy. Monumental wrecks looming over diminished populations of survivors, scrubbing for survival in the dirt. He wondered how it had been in that other timeline, in that other galaxy which had been overrun not by ghosts and chaks and spline ships, but by humanity. What ruins might have been left behind? They were soon spotted. Jophiel could see people climbing high in that enormous ribcage looking back at him. Descendants of the crew of a scattership, descendants of Jophiel's own contemporaries, in fact, clambering over the ribs of a dead alien. Max Ward was studying a rough map sketched on a soft screen. "Just so we know where we are," he pointed. "Here are the Rim Mountains. Here we are. The village of the people of the vanquished first slaver. Here's the river it sits by." He traced with a finger. "You can see how the river is a tributary of a greater artery that feeds into the ocean here. We think we see one of those crater-like structures there." He pointed to pyramidal icons, And here, 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 more of them. Not surprising. Asha consulted her own screen. From the air we spotted these structures all over the landscape, all about the same size, crater-like ring walls centered on mounds. We asked Wiener about them. She called them libraries. That's the best translation of her word, anyhow. Max scowled. Why would an illiterate culture need a library? Illiterate, maybe, but highly intelligent and highly sophisticated, Asher said. That's been evident since the start of our contact with them a week back. They are the descendants of a scattership crew, remember. We shouldn't make any assumptions.
Okay, Max said grudgingly.
But, look, we landed at random, and hit on these village folks at random. My view is we should go straight for the ocean. The flybys picked up more settlements there, even boats of some kind. The more sophisticated the culture, the more we'd have to gain. We'd even learn a lot more by cracking open one of those libraries.
Poole looked stern. We aren't cracking open anything, Max. We have two goals, remember? The ultimate aim is to find a way to get the Chili, but the second is to find the crew a place to live, now and in the future. And if that's to be here, we need to find a way to get along with the neighbours. These people know their world. We know nothing yet. We need to learn.
Max laughed. What's to learn from a bunch of degenerate savages? The answer, as Jophiel was not surprised to discover, turned out to be a great deal. They walked on. The village was a gaggle of teepees and other more functional structures, racks for hanging meat and furs, small workshops evidently for the manufacture of bows, arrows, clothing, various tools. Jophiel saw low fences, stockades which contained what looked like big, strong-looking rabbits. The teepees were of all sizes, but oddly the apparently ceremonial structure to which the guests were led was only the second largest. Two young people, one female, one male, sat watchfully on the ground outside the largest of all, which was sealed up. Cinello asked bluntly what was in there. The response was silence. Inside the designated teepee, under a conical roof, the elders of the village sat in a circle. Among them was Wiener, who seemed more impressed to be allowed into the elders' tent than by the presence of the folk from the Couchy. The visitors were handed clay cups containing what tasted like strong beer. Jophiel discreetly conjured up his own virtual beer cup in order to join the party. None of the elders showed any alarm, any more than when he had pulled similar stunts before Wiener back in the flyer. These seemed a phlegmatic people. Maybe that came from growing up under the wreck of a living starship. Jophiel, or his template, had always been more interested in engineering than people, technology rather than anthropology. Yet he had the feeling that this scene must have been played out in one form or another across the earth over many millennia. The strangers greeted in the tent, the sharing of gifts. The essence of what it was to be human, surviving at the centre of the galaxy. Jophiel found it somehow pleasing. Michael Poole, meanwhile, had quickly entered grave, if not very pointed, discussions with the elders, both sides translated by Couchy software. The villagers' talk was dominated by descriptions of relationships, marriages, legacies, hunting trophies, and some complex discussions of the mixture of farming, stock-rearing, and hunting that kept the people alive here. Primitive they were, but not ignorant. Not only that, they knew exactly where they had come from, and when. The most wizened of the elders said now,
"The people were brought to this world many days ago." "How many days?"
She worked her fingers in a complex sequence, which Jophiel guessed was some kind of finger-counting mnemonic. As she worked, Jophiel studied the fine tattoos on her face. He had already learned, by asking Weena about something she took for granted, that every person here was marked with an impression of the light and shade patterns in the sky on the day of their birth. If more than one was born on a particular day, especial care was taken to distinguish the zebra stripes. Thus, every person was made as unique as an individual day, maybe even a particular hour. Weena had been curious about why so many of the crew didn't wear tattoos at all, and what was the meaning of the green tetrahedra some wore on their foreheads. At length, the elder pronounced,
2,064,752 days on this world.
The translation back to standard, from which these people's language had evidently descended, was clearer when numbers were pronounced. Perhaps such core words defied linguistic shifting a little more than others. Now she flashed her withered fingers once more.
23 hours in the world's day. 24 in the ship's day. This is the true age of the land. Every 100 days we send a runner to the library with the numbers we count as we do like ourselves. The library remembers.
Asher leaned over to Jophiel and whispered,
They've remembered the key facts after all this time, and they must have counted every day since they came here. The first Australians were good astronomers in the same way, with a deep, shared memory of the sky. Not that the colonialists ever cared to learn about that.
Jophiel was working it out.
That number, though,
it translates back to 5,400 years, give or take, which maps to more than 2.5 million years outside. These people really are descended from Gordgru, aren't they? Just as Weena's bracelet was a clue. Crew who left Earth about when we did, 26 years ago by our ship's time, by our time, and were abducted not long into their journey. 5,000 years for them. 200 generations. I know we've been through lots of relativistic distortions on this journey. Every so often it hits you in the face. The human reality of it.
Asher nodded.
The flora and fauna here. After Susan Chen and the rest were dumped at Guba's Star, soon after the ship was captured, I imagine the rest of the Gord crew being dropped here along with samples of the Life Dome's content. The basic frame of the Cup World must already have been in place, the lands and oceans, the matter and energy cycles, the weather systems, maybe even some kind of basic ecosystem or a support for one. Maybe the Chile had some way of subtly helping out with that. I mean, if you can build mountains and oceans, making a little of the right type of soil, maybe with some kind of engineered bacteria sympathetic to our kind of life, isn't such a stretch. So, the crew was dumped here, and they unpacked and started to adapt, to build a home. Once Earth life got a foothold, it would have dug in and expanded. The Gord was like a green ship, like the island, parkland, trees and bushes and grass, and a little museum-piece farming. Corn, root vegetables, potatoes, and the animals. Not much besides chickens and rabbits.
And rats, Jophiel said. Don't forget the rats. I saw a gaggle of village kids playing with what I thought was a small dog. It wasn't.
So they survived, and spread out to the ocean shore and the mountains. The animals would have grown wild and evolved into new forms, or maybe rather recovered some of the characteristics that had been domesticated out of them. Human-driven adaptations that were only a few thousand years deep themselves, of course.
Jophiel glanced up.
That's the wreck of a spline ship up there.
A Guba Star, the Ghosts were using their own Tangle ships. Their opponents, the Chaks, used the spline.
Asher shrugged. So maybe the Chaks came here too. All the Ghosts captured their ships. It was a long war they fought.
This aspect of the wheel was troubling Jophiel, whenever he thought about it.
The Chili had crossed the galaxy to wipe out mankind. Why then create refuges for it here? But then, he realized, everything about the true agenda of the Chili in this place was still a mystery. A distant scream. Inside the teepee, everybody fell silent. A mutual wariness now turned to suspicious glares. The scream cut off abruptly. Mac stood up. That sounded like Chinello. Now Jovial heard a new voice, steadily repeating some kind of incantation or prayer or maybe a simple request. A voice that was familiar, but not human. A voice that was flat, mechanical, a wheezing, groaning tone. A voice that sounded to Jovial like a ghost. Everybody was on their feet now. Poole said, "Let's keep calm. Max, you make sure that squad of yours keeps their weapons out of sight. I mean it. I don't think our fragile relationship with these folks will stand another attempted murder." "Maybe not," Max said, glowering. "Even if it is our turn." "Elder Tomer," Poole said, bowing. "I suggest we see what the trouble is before we start blaming anybody. Our crew member Chinello is a child." "A child soldier," Max muttered. The elder woman glared at him. Poole insisted, "There may be some simple explanation for this." As it turned out, he was quite wrong. Outside that largest teepee, Chinello was being held by two burly locals with sharp stone blades at her throat. She looked alarmed, but not panicked. She was at the centre of quite a tableau, it seemed to Jovial. Everybody in the village seemed to have come across to see what the excitement was. Skin tattoos swirled around psychedelic faces. And a big rat, with a collar like a pet dog, ran excited through a forest of legs. Max Ward had to be physically held back from retrieving Chinello by Asher and Harris. "I didn't do anything," Chinello said as the party of seniors came bustling up. "Well, not much. I didn't mean to." Poole walked forward, grave, calm, and spoke to the elders. "This is a misunderstanding. This one is a child. Shut up, Max. Could she be released? I vouch for her behaviour." The elders shared glances. One nodded. Chinello was released and was left rubbing her shoulders and wrists, but her guards did not back off very far. "Tell us what happened," Poole commanded. "It was that teepee, the big one. They wouldn't let us see, so I went to look inside, wouldn't you?"
"No," Poole said bluntly. Chinello wasn't too frightened for a cocky grin Jovial saw.
"Well, I just ducked under the door. It was dark inside. No windows and door flaps like the teepee you went to. Before I could see what I was in there with..."
"Yes?"
"It spoke. Loud as the ship's general alarm. I jumped out of my skin. Then I saw it. I had to get out of there, that was all I thought. So I got my knife..."
"Please, kill me now."
The voice was clipped, somewhat artificial, stilted, but resonant, clear. It carried on the cool air, and it spoke standard. Everybody shut up. Asher was by the teepee, sneaking a peek, Jovial saw.
"Leith, I can see it. Where Chinello ripped the cover. You'd better come look, Michael."
Jovial stepped forward with the others from the couchy. As these strangers approached their violated Holy of Holies, at a gesture from the elder, the locals held back. But Jovial had the impression that if this incident unfolded badly over the next few minutes, there would be a lot of arrows flying. Max was fingering a blaster at his waist. That big teepee had ripped open from top to bottom, far beyond Chinello's reach. Jovial wondered if the covering was so old it had been ready to fall apart anyhow. Through the rent,
The teepee's interior, enclosed by a frame of sapling trunks, was easily visible. And inside... At first, Jophiel only saw a glint of silver, a smooth curve. A silver sphere, fat and full, 2 meters wide. It was a ghost. And it was pinned in place. A pyramid of wooden staves had been driven through it, from above, into its skin and out again, and then thrust into the ground. Also, there was a wider cubicle frame around the ghost, sturdily tied together and rooted in the ground. From this, more stakes pierced the ghost, from side to side, from top to bottom. It was a peculiarly precise arrangement, like a geometrical demonstration, a frame around a sphere. But the perfection of it was marred by what looked like dried blood on the hide near the wounds. The elder gestured as if in disgust and contempt.
"Behold, the first slaver vanquished, as you can see."
And the ghost said, "Save me, Michael Poole." Chapter 54. Poole reached out a hand, as if to touch the silver hide within the wooden cage, but pulled back.
"It's as if it has been crucified."
Jophiel murmured to Max,
"Slaver. They call themselves the people of the first slavers. But that implies there were other slavers."
"Yeah," Max growled. "Folk from the ocean. I talked to some of their youngsters. They have bloodthirsty stories of raiders coming on ships. Every few generations it seems to happen. Maybe originating in other colonies along the coast or islands. We haven't properly surveyed this place. They invade, murder, and rape, and take your children. The settled folk recover, band together to drive them out, even exterminate them, but then a new generation rises and it starts all over again. So they know about slavers. And their folk memory of the ghosts is of slavers who brought their distant ancestors to this world in the first place. The first slavers seems apt." Max grinned cruelly. "Except, it seems, that one of them got caught. Hey, no wonder that savage Wiener took a dislike to Nicola. She must have recognized the ghost hide. To her, Nicola was a human-shaped ghost walking free. She took no chances."
Nor would I have.
Good reaction." The ghost had fallen silent, as if waiting. Poole faced it. "I am Michael Poole. You spoke my name. You are feared. You are worshipped. Not for anything I did. Some of your kind know of me, of my actions in another timeline. Are you in pain?"
"Yes."
"How long have you been held like this?"
"Since the first coming of the ghosts to this structure."
"We call it the wheel."
"Yes."
"When was that?"
"Over 5,000 years ago. As the crew of the Gord count time. We used faster-than-light technology, which..."
"You brought them here?"
"We came to colonize. That is evidently the purpose of the structure. The spin gravity, the confined worlds. There are environments suitable for ghosts and humans and many other kinds, even spline or their aquatic forebears. We came here to accept the implicit invitation of the structure. It was an experiment to study the artifact and its purpose, to see how well we could live here on the terraces."
"The decks. This is a cup world. This structure is the wheel. These are the words we have used."
"Yes, decks. Cup worlds. I will use your words as I learn them."
"So you brought humans too?"
"Yes. We brought some of the crew of the ship called the Gord. We preserved the rest of the crew in other places."
"We know. We found them. At Goober's Star. I'll show you a star map." The ghost said nothing to that.
We brought samples of the ecohab with which the vessel had been equipped. We wish to study humans. If we witnessed the evolution of a human culture without prior resources, we could learn a great deal.